Redistricting is back in the news in Ohio. Could a new map tip the balance of power in Congress? You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we'll discuss the implications, plus a new analysis on how much Paycor Stadium renovations will cost taxpayers in the years to come. And Cincinnati Public Schools is suing the Federal Education Department. Joining me now to get us started are Cincinnati Inquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and state government reporter Jesse Ballmert. Welcome back, Haley and Jesse.
Thanks for having us.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you both. Jesse, Ohio lawmakers are gearing up to redraw the state's congressional map. Why? Didn't we just go through this?
Yeah, it is kind of the song that never ends. But basically, because there wasn't any Democratic support of the last congressional map, it only lasted for two election cycles. So we need to draw a new one for 2026.
Haley, are Democratic lawmakers going to have any say in this, or do Republicans control the whole process?
Yeah, Democrats really don't have much they can influence here. Republicans control the legislature, which means they control the kind of first step of the map-making process. They also have a majority on the Ohio Redistricting Commission. And this time around, there's a 6-1 Republican majority on the state Supreme Court, which is going to hear any challenges to these maps. And unlike last time, all of the Republican justices are likely to be more favorable to what the Republican lawmakers do, whereas last time around, we had former Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, who sided with Democrats on a lot of rulings.
Jesse, walk us through this process. How will these maps get drawn?
Yeah, so the ultimate deadline is the end of November, November 30th, and that's when we have to have a map for the next election cycle that would last the next three election cycles. And that's partially because people have to decide where they're going to run. But the first step of the process is Ohio lawmakers have a chance to pass a map. At that phase, they would need to get 3/5 of all lawmakers on board and at least half of the Democratic Party members on board. If that doesn't happen, which I think is unlikely to happen, we move to the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which includes 4 lawmakers and 3 statewide elected officials. As Haley said, that's going to be 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats. At that phase, both Democrats would need to sign on to a map for it to be approved. And then if that doesn't happen, we kick it back to the Ohio legislature. Ultimately, Republicans could pass this map without any Democratic support. If that's the case, they have to follow some more specific rules about like what they can and cannot do.
What kind of opportunity does this present for Republicans, Jesse?
Well, you're seeing really kind of the backdrop of all this is midterm elections tend to be a little bit problematic or not as successful for the party of the president. So if you think nationwide Democrats might have a good year in 2026, Republicans in Congress are trying to insulate themselves from some of that by picking up more seats in states where they control the redistricting process. So Ohio and then Texas is another example. And so Ohio's current congressional map, there are 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. If you could increase that by 2 or even 3 Republicans, that helps avoid some of the losses that you might face elsewhere in the nation.
Hmm. Well, voters defeated a redistricting reform proposal that was on last year's ballot. Jesse, are redistricting reform efforts failing nationwide?
It really depends on the measure. I think Ohio modeled theirs off of Michigan's, and Michigan's was successful in getting passed and being used for their last maps. Ohio passed redistricting reform in 2015 and 2018, but I think there's a lot of frustration with that process and how it worked and didn't work, and that there really weren't enough like penalties to force people to follow the rules, for example. So we'll see how this process goes. I think that is one way that Republicans who control most of this process could be, I guess, reined in a bit, is if they fear backlash to a really extreme map. from voters or another redistricting effort. But people spend a lot of money in Ohio in 2024 to ultimately lose. So it's hard to see if they're going to like want to spend that money immediately again.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the midterms and how they don't usually, we talked about how they don't usually go well for the party in the White House or in control. Do you think, Jesse, that's why President Trump is weighing in on these efforts? I mean, he's been talking about trying to pick up seats through redistricting, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think that's exactly why there's a kind of national interest from Republicans to try to pick up some seats. A lot of that focus has been on Texas because they're currently going through the process. But I imagine as Ohio gets ramped up, you're going to see a lot of Republicans from D.C.'s eyeballs on the state of Ohio.
Yeah. What should Ohio's congressional map look like? Is there any consensus on that?
There is no consensus on that. I think Democrats, the argument of the people who put forth redistricting reform is that Ohio's congressional map should reflect the statewide voting balance of the state. So if you think Donald Trump won the state by 11 percentage points in 2024, and yet on the congressional districts, there's, you know, two-thirds are controlled by Republicans, and there's a push to increase that number. So by that metric, Ohio's maps are out of sync with what voters are voting on in these, like, federal big elections. But again, a lot of this comes down to, like, who has control over the process. And right now, that's predominantly the Republican Party in Ohio.
Haley, you know, we talked about Ohio does have some U.S. Senate seats that are held by Democrats. I assume those are the most likely targets, but could those district lines be redrawn in a way that doesn't cause trouble for Republicans in other districts?
I think it's possible, depending on which districts you're looking at. You know, Representative Marcy Kaptur, I think, is target number one for Republicans. Her district has been gradually drawn more Republican. She's still winning. I suspect they're going to try to make that area even redder. Same with Representative Amelia Sykes up in the Akron area. But both of those districts are surrounded by Republicans who have won their races in the past by, I mean, double-digit margins. A lot of these areas are very red, very conservative. And so I think to some extent you can dip into that a little bit without hurting them too much. Whether the representatives themselves get a little cranky about that, I guess we'll see. But I think there is room for Republicans to finagle with that if they want to.
What about Congressman Greg Landsman here in the Cincinnati area? Would redrawing his district potentially hurt Congressman Warren Davidson?
You know, that's another one. I think Davidson's district is pretty comfortable, but he's also been running into some trouble with his own party recently because of his pushback against Trump's Big Beautiful Bill and things like that. I do think Landsman is probably the hardest Democrat to, you know, draw out of office at this point for Republicans, just because Hamilton County has gotten a lot more Democratic in recent years. So I think if they tinker with his, that's probably the more ambitious of kind of the three options we've laid out here. But I think Davidson has some margin that, you know, he could lose. But again, that also depends if, you know, he's going to be dealing with his own primary or any other challenges.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, when it comes to the issue of elections and potentially manipulating elections, a federal appeals court is going to be weighing in. Tell us about this issue of non-citizens donating to campaigns.
Yeah, the history of this goes back to when President Joe Biden was still running for president, and Ohio needed to move the deadline for getting on the ballot. And in exchange for that concession to Democrats, Ohio Republican-controlled General Assembly passed a law that essentially said that foreign nationals, lawful permanent residents, typically known as green card holders, could not donate to ballot issue campaigns. And this was largely in response to the abortion rights measure that passed in 2023, but they were concerned that some of that money was going to be spent or was being spent on the redistricting measure in 2024 as well. And so this law has been challenged. It went to a district court judge who found it unconstitutional. Now it's at the appeals court level. A appeals court panel did kind of reinstitute this law while they take a look at the legal arguments of it. So that's where we are right now.
And Jesse, for the people who support this ban, why do they think it's important?
Yeah, I think there's been a long opposition to foreign influence in elections. Both state and federal law prohibits individuals from foreign countries from donating to candidates. There's been a lot of opposition to like foreign countries meddling in U.S. elections. And so they see this as an extension of that effort.
What about the argument for allowing these donations, Jesse? What are people saying on that side of the argument?
So there's two things that people, well, probably a few things that they don't like about this law, but one of them is it affects lawful permanent residents, so green card holders who have had more rights and more access to like First Amendment protections than others. And so that particular group, there was a lot of debate when even this law was passed, whether they could be legally included in this restriction. The argument is also, you know, even if you're not voting on this ballot issue, you live here, it affects you. This is your ability to, you know, speak on a topic that might impact you and your neighborhood. Another thing that opponents don't like is this law is going to be enforced by the Ohio Attorney General, which is an elected position. And so there is some concern from nonprofits or unions that obtain this money that the Attorney General could go after them, even if they are, you know, an Ohio-based nonprofit, because they accepted donations from someone that they didn't check their citizenship status of.
Okay. Well, Haley, let's turn to the Ohio House. The House convened this week to consider several of the budget provisions that Governor Mike DeWine vetoed. How did the governor explain his vetoes related to property taxes?
He vetoed, I believe, four different measures, and he said that while he thought there were some interesting ideas here, he was worried that too many of these changes at the same time would hurt school districts especially, but he's also just concerned in general about making sure that local services from mental health to police and fire have the money that they need, recognizing that a lot of that money in Ohio does come from local property taxes and not the state level.
Republican Representative David Thomas supports overriding the governor's vetoes. Democratic Representative Dunny Isaacson says overriding these vetoes will hurt communities and schools.
We're in a crisis. And when you're in a crisis, you act immediately.
The governor saw through this effort. So do we.
So, Haley, we heard two different perspectives there. What did lawmakers do about these vetoes?
They ended up overriding one of DeWine's vetoes. So that move will get rid of two different types of levies that school districts and local governments can put on the ballot, replacement and emergency levies. Without getting too in the weeds, Republicans say that these levies are confusing and not the most transparent because with the way they work, you can end up with a higher tax bill without realizing it. Democrats say that, you know, there does need to be more transparency in the system, but the focus should be giving people tax relief, and this stuff is not going to do that. The House did table two other vetoes that they were thinking about doing this week. And it sounds like they're going to try again later this year. But House Speaker Matt Huffman said, at least for this week, they didn't quite have the votes. They needed to talk about everything a little bit more.
Haley, I don't know if I'm asking you the impossible here, but can you explain briefly what these replacement levies and emergency levies are?
Yeah, so emergency levies allow local governments to put a levy on the ballot that says it's either for an emergency purpose or to avoid an operating deficit. replacement levies kind of are similar to another type of levy, a renewal levy, but replacement levies, they essentially re-up a levy with new property values taken into account. So it could be the same tax rate, but your home is valued at a higher amount now. And so because of that, your tax bill is higher, even though you may have seen this on the ballot and thought, you know, nothing was going to change because it was the same tax rate. So that's kind of the crux of those two. With the emergency levies, proponents of getting rid of them have said that, you know, governments and schools have been able to use these over the years for things that aren't true emergencies, but because the word emergency is in there, it sounds very urgent and important.
Hmm. So, Haley, is the Senate going to be able to vote to override the measure the House voted to override, this veto that was related to these replacement levies and emergency levies?
I think so. I think the override votes are honestly going to be an easier lift in the Senate, as long as it's something that Senate Republicans want to do, which, as far as I know, they're interested in looking at the override that the House did this week. You know, there are a lot more personalities in the House, more people, even in the Republican majority. So it's harder to wrangle those folks, especially when there are differing opinions of these specific policies. You know, when the budget passes, it's one vote on everything, but the overrides have to be taken up individually. And so you may have lawmakers that said, well, I liked this thing in the budget, but I didn't like this property tax thing, so I don't know if I want to support putting that back necessarily.
Haley, what's happening when it comes to broader property tax relief? This is something that state lawmakers have been talking about for months and months now.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much nothing, honestly. You know, there have been these efforts in the budget to do something, especially in response to this proposed amendment out there that would get rid of property taxes altogether. But there are a lot of differing ideas, and the legislature really hasn't been able to reach a solution. Governor Mike DeWine, when he vetoed some of this stuff, he did form a new working group that started this week that's going to be looking at this issue and providing policy recommendations by the end of September. We'll see if anything major comes out of that. There are some lawmakers who are frustrated with that whole idea right now, so I'm not sure to what extent they'll listen.
Well, let's talk now about EdChoice. Haley, we talked before on this program about an Ohio judge's recent ruling that the state school voucher program is unconstitutional. Now the state has made it official that it's going to appeal. Is that right?
Yeah, they believe that the district court got it wrong. They're quite confident that the voucher program will stand up in court, especially in the wake of a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision. So we'll see how that plays out. And I anticipate if they don't like what happens at the appeals court, that the attorney general will take this to the Ohio Supreme Court.
Jesse, can you explain what Ohio's EdChoice voucher program is for people who aren't familiar?
Yeah, so this was a program initially that was aimed at lower income families and giving them an alternative in the private school sector. It's a kind of like a scholarship. You receive money to go to a private school instead of a public school, and that's taxpayer funded dollars. In 2023, the Ohio legislature expanded that to basically everyone in Ohio, regardless of income. The amount of money that you get towards that EdChoice voucher, it's different based on your income. And so that dramatically increased the number of people taking advantage of this voucher system, and then dramatically increased how much the state of Ohio was paying for it.
Haley, what was the judge's rationale behind the ruling that the program is unconstitutional?
They said that it's basically creating two different school systems when Ohio does have an obligation to fund public schools adequately. And there's a broader concern among public school districts, which brought this lawsuit, that if the school's funneling a bunch of money to the voucher program, that they will not be adequately funded. House Speaker Matt Huffman contends that the Ohio Constitution requires the state to also fund private and religious schools, but that's an interpretation that not everyone agrees with.
Well, here's Tom Fisher from EdChoice Legal Advocates, who opposes the judge's ruling.
Our opponents operate under the mistaken impression that Ohio must choose between a robust public school system and a voucher program. But Ohio can and does have both.
Haley, tell us more about why public schools sued in the first place.
Yeah, I think it goes back to this idea that they think, you know, this is really just siphoning money away from the public school system. And, you know, this latest budget was another example of the frustration of public schools that they don't feel like the state is adequately funding them, funding the school funding formula that was enacted several years ago. And they feel like it's been a bigger priority for Republicans in the legislature to fund private schools. And, you know, they see a scenario where if more kids are going to private school, that's less kids at schools. That means less money and therefore less resources available to the students who are still there.
Jesse, as I understand it, students can still use these EdChoice vouchers this coming school year. So what's next with this case?
Yeah, so this is currently going to be appealed to the 10th District Court of Appeals, which is based in Columbus. And the majority, if not all of the judges on that district appeals court are Democrats. And so it'll be interesting to see if they side with the original judge's decision, who is also a Democrat. As Haley mentioned, if that's the case, this will really either way, this is going to end up at the Ohio Supreme Court, which the current balance of the Supreme Court is 6 Republicans and 1 Democrat. And as you said, the EdChoice voucher system is still going. It's still operational. Students and families are taking advantage of that. That's because the initial Common Pleas Court judge in Franklin County knew that this case was going to be appealed and effectively put her decision on hold preemptively.
Okay, well, plenty to keep watching there. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer, state government reporter Jesse Balmert, and political reporter Haley B. Miller. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. Up next, how much will Paycor Stadium renovations cost taxpayers in the long run? We'll talk about it. This is Cincinnati Edition. How much will the renovation of Paycor Stadium cost taxpayers in the years to come? A new analysis offers an answer. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about that analysis and what it found is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming into the studio. We have been talking a lot on this program about Hamilton County's renovation plan for Paycor Stadium, how the county's contribution will be capped at $350 million. But your analysis shows county taxpayers could end up paying more than that. How much more are we talking about, Dan?
Well, what's $1 billion between friends?
It's a lot. I mean, I like you, but I don't have $1 billion to give you.
$1.1 billion was my estimate based on the contract terms that they disclosed in their letter of intent recently.
That's $1.1 billion over how many years?
Over 21 years. That assumes that the lease will run the first 11 years and then be renewed 5 times at 2 years each. So that's what they outlined in the document. So my goal here was to say how much can this cost or how much will this cost over the life of the agreement, and that's what I came up with.
Okay, based on what's been released so far, which isn't the final lease, it's the plan that the letter of intent or whatever they're calling it.
Yes.
So can you walk us through kind of how you got that total? That's a big number.
First big number was $470 million, which is what they said they were going to spend. And they also said that the county spending would be capped at $350 million. So that those two numbers went in the formula, along with the $120 million that the Bengals and the NFL have pledged to this project. So that was publicly announced. That's the number everybody heard. And then I went a little bit deeper by estimating the cost of some of the other contract terms that are identified in this document.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable walking us through some of that math?
Yeah. So first of all, you have rent. Well, let's start with the interest, because it's not technically in the document, but on the day they announced it, they said they were going to borrow the $350 million.
So that's how the county— they don't just have that sitting around.
Exactly. So the county's going to borrow that money. And so I came up with an estimate of $210 million in interest payments. And that's based on just interest calculators that you can find on the internet. And so I just typed in 4% interest for 15 years. They said they're going to do a 15-year bond deal. Bond deals are not quite the same as mortgage documents, but, you know, it's a rough estimate of what the interest payments are going to be over the 15-year life of this loan that they're planning to make.
You're kind of famous for these interest payments. I remember you did some calculations for the first stadium
deal.
Nobody
likes it when I add the interest.
Nobody likes it when you add the interest.
I should say, though, that I shared this analysis with the Bengals and the county. Neither one commented on any of the analysis, but, they didn't also say, you're dead wrong. So we've got that going for us.
Yeah.
And then on the other estimates, rent and capital payments. The county agreed to make capital payments over the life of the new lease that they're planning to sign. And then the Bengals promised to make rent payments over the life of the lease. And the way it goes is the Bengals start at $1 million and
for rent,
and the county starts at $3 million for capital.
And that's year. They put it in a fund for when a capital needs that need to happen. Okay,
that's correct. Yeah, and so they spend that amount for 3 years, then they double the totals. So the county goes to $2 million in year four.
Bengals go to $2
million. Bengals go to $2 million in year four, and the county goes to $6 million in year four. And then after that, it inflates at the rate of inflation limited to 2.5%. So I just took that year four figure and inflated it by 2.5% per year for the life of the agreement. And I came up with $45 million in rent for the Bengals and $134 million in capital payments by the county.
Wow. Okay. So I'm trying to follow this math. But as you know, math is not my strong suit, Dan. We've known each other a long time.
I think we're up to at about $600 or $700 million now total. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's more, it sounds like.
That's okay. Right. The big number is operating expenses, which is another $418 million. And that brings you to $1.1 billion. And the way I arrived at that figure was I took what the county has budgeted for personnel and other expenses, not including debt, not including capital, for 2026. So they just came out with a new tax budget for 2026, and they estimated the spending on the football stadium. And so that was close to $17 million. And I just inflated that at 2% per year over 21 years, and that's how I came up with $418 million.
Mm, okay. And how much will the Bengals be paying? If county taxpayers, based on your analysis, are paying $1.1 billion over the life of this agreement, 21 years, how much will the Bengals be paying?
$165 million. So, yeah. Okay. About 13%, 14%.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be my next question. So, because I know that one of the big arguments about the original lease was that county taxpayers paid the vast majority. I think it was some estimates are more than 90% of the costs, and the Bengals paid, you know, the rest, which was much smaller. And the county commissioners have said they wanted to really change that ratio.
Yeah.
So, what percentage will the county be paying over the life of this, based on your analysis, and what percentage will the Bengals be paying?
I think it was 86% for the county and 14% for the Bengals, if I remember correctly. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that was roughly the percentage. That would change if the state chips in, because the state will add, in theory, $250 million. To the mix, and so the Bengals number goes down a little bit. The county's number goes down. The state number goes up. And the total price tag of the project rises by – they're not going to just recover costs if the state gives them money. They're going to add to the scope of the project and build something else with that money instead of what they're planning to build now.
Okay. Yeah, because the original plan for this was a much bigger renovation than what they've got in this letter of intent, wasn't it?
Right. It was north of $1.5 billion, I believe. That's what the original proposal was that the county released, and then the team never really did endorse that number, and eventually they arrived at this smaller number that they announced in their letter of intent at the end of June.
And that was $1.5 billion before interest, right?
That's right.
I know you're about the interest. I just want to make sure we're clear with the people.
You got to report what it's going to cost.
Yeah.
That is what it's going to cost.
Yeah. So you said you ran this by the team and the county, didn't get any response from them about it, good or bad. Did you run this analysis by any other experts, people who are familiar with these kinds of deals?
Yeah, I ran it by Joe Cobbs, who's a professor. Teaches sports business at Northern Kentucky University. And he said it was a reasonable estimate of what it's going to actually cost. You know, one of the things we talked about with Joe was the operating expenses, $418 million. And, you know, that is money that is technically money that the county already spends now. I included it in this analysis because the county actually negotiated for the Bengals to pay a larger share or some share of operating expenses, and the county ultimately did not in this final letter of intent. Whether it's going to be in the lease that's announced later this month, I don't know. I kind of doubt it, but you know, I thought it was fair to include that because this is a new lease. They negotiated a new deal, and I thought it was fair to say what that's going to cost. If the Bengals are not going to contribute to operating, if they're not going to share revenue to offset the cost of operating, then all of these operating costs that they're now paying need to be counted as an expense for the new lease.
The taxpayers will be paying.
Right. It's a taxpayer expense. Right.
Yeah. What did Joe Cobbs say about any economic benefit that the county might be getting? I mean, are they getting anything? I know one of the big criticisms of the original lease was the county was exposed to so much risk that they, you know, that there was kind of this checkbook that could keep paying for new things with the Bengals stadium.
Yeah, he did think the county has eliminated some risk with this new deal, and that was one of the points they were making when they announced the deal, is that they had no idea before this lease what they were going to have to spend in capital. There was this famous clause in the lease where 14 NFL teams get something really fabulous for their stadiums. The Bengals had the ability to force the county to build it in Paycor Stadium. And that lease will go away that lease clause will go away with the new lease. And I mean, there were other factors too. It seemed like every time the Bengals and the county talked about a lease term that the county objected to, the Bengals would walk away with some new concession. That's how the bubble got built, the practice bubble. And that's how Hilltop got acquired on the riverfront, which gives the Bengals more space, you know, possibly for an expansion or for parking or for whatever they want to use it for. But, you know, that's now part of the lease. And so more of the riverfront has been acquired by the county as a result of these lease negotiations and lease terms that have to be dealt with over time.
Yeah. And was that clause about fancy stuff? Do I remember, was that called the hologram clause or something?
One of the examples was a holographic replay system. So they were just listing examples of things that might be invented in the future.
Yeah.
Holographic replay system. And self-warming seats or stadium-warming seats or something like that. No, self-cleaning seats. I think that's what it was. Yeah.
I don't know about that. Okay. So when could the final lease deal be signed? I mean, they still won't have a deal. This is a letter of intent that you've analyzed. What's the deadline for the deal?
Well, the current deadline is July 31st, and they actually think they're going to hit that from what I've heard. So that's next week, and we'll see if they finalize it. If they don't finalize it, they could always do another extension, and then, you know, the lease will then be signed and start whenever that that deal is finalized. But from what I'm hearing, they're making progress on the final document.
Well, it sounds like we might be talking to you again soon then, if the deadline is coming up next week. And if our listeners want to see more details about your math and what's included, am I correct that they can find that on WCPO.com?
You are correct in that, okay. Yes. It's explained.
And my tip is to hit that iTeam tab at the top. At the top, you can find Dan's story very easily that way.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll try that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan. It's been fun talking with you.
Me too. Thanks.
Up next, Cincinnati Public Schools joins a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Education. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Public Schools is joining a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Education. Joining me now to explain is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. I mentioned that Cincinnati Public Schools is joining this lawsuit. What's the lawsuit about? Is this about funding?
This is about funding. So this is related to a federal grant funding freeze for education. So at the end of June, early July, state education departments were notified that the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education, was freezing funding for certain grants. And a lot of these were related to students learning English, professional development for teachers, adult learners, after-school programs, that kind of thing. These certain federal grant-funded programs, they were frozen just a day before these funds were supposed to be dispersed. So this caught pretty much all states by surprise here. They were expecting this money, millions of dollars in these states from the federal government. Suddenly, they were notified that it wasn't coming.
How much money is at stake nationwide? You said millions of dollars for states. I mean, what are we talking about across the country?
We're looking at over $6 billion, almost $7 billion nationwide that was suddenly frozen, really without any warning and without much of a reason given. It was a sweeping freeze. It wasn't kind of individualized or really looked at in that way. It was just kind of a blanket freeze, and certainly it was something that, you know, Democrats, Republicans, both sides of the aisle were caught by surprise by, because this was funding previously approved and passed by Congress. Now, when that happens, when you have funds approved by Congress, it also needs an act of Congress to rescind those funds, a rescission package. We know about that
we're
in
all
public
familiar.
Media.
Yeah.
So same case for this. You need a rescission package to take that funding away, which has not happened yet.
How much for Ohio? Do you know what the amount is for Ohio? If it's almost $7 billion across the country?
So in total, at first, it was $184 million for the state of Ohio. That's how much money the education department is losing out on when this was announced at the beginning of July. So millions of dollars, and for certain districts, millions as well.
We've been talking about the U.S. Department of Education, but as I understand it, it's the Office of Budget and Management that's been kind of explaining the rationale behind the decision to freeze this funding. What has OMB said about that?
Yeah, OMB and the U.S. Department of Education are named in this lawsuit, but questions directed at the U.S. Department of Education are being sent to the Office of Management and Budget. And I had emailed them last week asking about an update on these things. And what they sent me was that their initial findings found that these grant programs, and these are their words, grossly abused to promote radical left-wing DEI agendas and to subsidize the open border crisis and violate presidential executive orders. That was the reason for this funding freeze, the idea that states and school districts were using these programs to push diversity, equity, and inclusion, a woke agenda. We've heard that before. That was the reason they were giving. And once they sent me that answer, actually an hour later, they sent me another message saying that the funding for summer and after school programs nationwide had been unfrozen. So one answer 1 hour, and then an hour later, kind of they pulled back a little bit.
Yeah, sort of a thawing of that freeze, at least for some of the funds.
For some of it.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that, but first getting back to this bigger picture, this bigger pot of money, do you know what that would mean for Cincinnati Public Schools specifically and what kind of programs are at risk if the district doesn't get that money?
Yeah. So in total, what was frozen for CPS was $5.2 million. So this was for a handful of different programs. Some of this was for advanced placement course curriculum, AP courses, teacher training, some of that for those courses, and also programming for 2,000 students who are English language learners within CPS. So that's translation services and other kinds of social support for immigrant students and students who don't speak English in the household per se.
What have you heard from Cincinnati Public Schools board members about this? Or what are they saying about this lawsuit, about this funding?
Yeah, I spoke to board member Ben Lindy, who was really the first one on the school board to kind of publicly come out and call for the school district to get involved in a lawsuit and really go after the Trump administration and the White House for this freeze. And basically what they said is this seemed like a kind of political game, a political move to kind of take money away from schools. Ben Lindy said, this was, of course, already approved by Congress, and he called it unlawful and really just a totally reckless decision by the federal government to pull these funds once again, about a month out from the start of the school year. So a lot of these school districts have been kind of left scrambling, trying to figure out what to do with millions of dollars suddenly short, and there's not a ton of answers right now.
What is this lawsuit seeking, the lawsuit that CPS has joined now?
They're seeking to restore funds nationwide. So that is the main objective here. So CPS joined this lawsuit with a number of different education organizations across the country, as well as three public school districts in Alaska who are also losing out on millions of dollars in funding. They actually have a lot of migrant students there in Alaska too. So kind of some critical funding for those school districts there. So a little bit of something in common with those districts, which is why they kind of came together on this lawsuit. Democracy Forward, which is a legal advocacy organization, is kind of leading this and representing these school districts and covering the costs there. So it's not really costing CPS anything to be joining this lawsuit. And right now they are seeking a preliminary injunction or a stay on this federal freeze to kind of get these funds released before the school year for schools nationwide.
Any idea when there could be movement on that, when a court could decide whether to grant that or not?
Yes. I did write this down, but I don't have it in front of me. But there is going to be a hearing for this preliminary injunction at the beginning of next month. The exact date, I'll probably put a story out with the exact date. I wish I wrote it down in front of me. But yes, there is going to be a hearing for a preliminary injunction in federal court. So it certainly could be granted to school districts nationwide at the beginning of August before school starts. So that is kind of what they're seeking right now. But of course, they're trying to fully restore all of these funds.
Yeah. Well, and I know we'll just keep an eye on WVXU.org and keep a listen out for your stories on 91.7. When does school start for CPS? I know you said that early August, so that's before the school year starts. But what's the first day? Do you remember?
I shouldn't say the exact date because but August 20-something is when schools will open for CPS. So obviously, it's crunch time right now for them. And people who have been following the school district know that they just went through a huge budget cutting dozens of millions of dollars, trying to get that budget balanced for the beginning of the school year. That meant laying off teachers and staff members and trimming all different kinds of departments and programs. So to have another $5 million kind of thrown on top of that with only a few weeks before the start of the school year, that's kind of an impossible position for the school district to be put in, which is what motivated them to join this lawsuit. And I should add that CPS was one of the few school districts in Ohio to not go along with the DEI ban that was being pushed by the Department of Education as well. There was only a handful of schools in Ohio that kind of went along with CPS on that. CPS was certainly the largest. But certainly what we're seeing here is that didn't really matter. It didn't really matter if CPS was going along with the Trump administration. Other school districts were, and yet in the same boat here, still losing out on federal funding, even though they played ball.
Hmm. You mentioned that the Office of Management and Budget told you that the decision had been made to release some funds to states. That's for these, is it 21st Century Community Learning Centers? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, these 21st Century Community Learning Centers, they run a lot of after-school programs. They do summer programs for kids in the summer. I actually went and visited one here at the Cincinnati Nature Center. It took kids from the west side of Cincinnati and really brought them out to experience nature and learn about animals and birds. So we were there, you know, tagging birds and kind of setting them off. And we got to hold a cardinal and kind of look at its wings and kind of see how it behaves, tag it, and then, you know, release it back into the wild. They also got to swim in a waterfall and a kind of a natural body of water there and kind of learn about that as well. So these are programs that historically have seen a lot of bipartisan support. I think both sides of the aisle kind of agree that it's good to have kids involved in programs during the summer, especially after school. You know, it's good for their education. It cuts down on, you know, crime as well. So certainly it's something that has seen a lot of bipartisan support. And we're kind of seeing that in the response to this because, you know, 24 states in D.C., those 24 states led by Democratic governors have filed a lawsuit. And then just last week, the 10 U.S. senators who are Republicans wrote a letter to Trump and the Office of Management and Budget asking for all of these funds to be released. They did mention that they are against DEI and schools kind of pushing certain left-wing agendas, but they say that's not happening here. There's no reason to be doing this. It's only harming students. It's only harming states. So now they're calling for the Trump administration to release the rest of it. It worked for these after-school programs, so now they're trying to take it one step further, unfreeze all of it.
Do the states know yet, Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, do they know yet how much is unfrozen for these programs?
How much is unfrozen for each state? So in Ohio, the after-school funding that was unfrozen was $46 million, and then it's about just under $20 million for Kentucky and Indiana apiece. So that's with Kentucky and Indiana, that's 40 plus 146.
We won't make you do math on the left.
Or sorry, 46, 86 million, yeah. About that. So for Kentucky, yeah. Ohio, and Indiana. So
yeah.
A significant portion already unfrozen, but certainly even more that is still frozen and they're still waiting for an answer for this. And certainly the Office of Management and Budget has not provided a timeline. They have not explained what their review process is. And they also mentioned that there was going to be guidelines in place for this after-school funding that was unfrozen, but they haven't said what those guidelines are, and the Department of Education in Kentucky told me that they actually received more funding than they anticipated from the Department of Education. So it didn't look like there was really much of a review of these programs, like they were picking a program and taking funding for that out. So unclear what the review was, because it seems like all of the funding that was under review was restored.
Huh. Well, I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks so much for your time today, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Her son, Dorian, is her helper today. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.